One of the first words that you find associated with the life of Jesus Christ is worship. Now that might surprise you, but if you were to study worship in the New Testament, you would begin with passages like Matthew 2 and verse 2, saying, "Where is he that is born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him." I want to look for some time on Sunday nights. I want to go through all the places in the New Testament and look at where the word worship is used. We can, if we do this study, find some very practical lessons when it comes to worship. One of the things that we will find is that only God is worthy of worship. If it was right for Jesus to be worshipped, Matthew chapter 2 and verse 2, that tells us that Jesus is deity. Only deity is worthy of worship. Jesus was worshipped. Therefore, the necessary conclusion is he was God in the flesh. Unless someone is willing to argue that the wise men somehow made a mistake, this is proof that Jesus was God in the flesh. Now, if Jesus was worthy of worship as a baby, what about now, since he is enthroned in heaven? Well, he certainly would deserve the very best that we can offer as far as worship. When we meet on the Lord's Day, when we come together Sunday after Sunday to worship, it's serious business. This is a really significant act, and we want to make sure that we get it right. We sing songs, as we talked about this morning, when it comes to worship. But we don't sing those songs to entertain people. We don't sing those songs to merely pass time. It's not something that is just a custom. We sing those songs to worship. As you continue to read through Matthew chapter 2, you read about this king by the name of Herod. And Herod learned about Jesus. Herod was afraid after he got some information about the Lord. And after Herod has a chance to speak to the wise men, he also uses this word which is translated worship, Matthew chapter 2 and verse 8. He sends the wise men to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search diligently for the young child. And when ye have found him, bring me word again that I may come," and there's that word again, "that I may worship him." Here's this wicked, here's this vile king, and he says, "I want to worship Jesus." Well, he, of course, was lying through his teeth. He wanted to find out where Jesus was so he could take the Lord's life. And there's a practical lesson here from Matthew chapter 2 and verse 8. Not everyone who talks about worship is interested in worship. We see that from the life of Herod. Not everyone who comes to worship engages in worship. In fact, there are some people who will come to worship or they will use worship to cover up bad behavior. And that's sad, that's unfortunate, that's wrong, but that is simply the way that it is. Now, it's impossible for us as human beings, we're not God. We cannot look into the hearts of people and determine why they are or maybe they are not at worship. But God knows. And God not only knows, he knows all the time. He knew the hearts of the wise men. He also knew the hearts of this king. Moving down just a little bit more, same chapter, Matthew chapter 2 and verse 11. The wise men find the young Jesus. And once they find Jesus, the text says that they fell down and they worshiped him and they also offered some gifts unto him. Let's think about those words "fell down" for just a second. Those two words are not trying to tell us that these two fellows were clumsy and they lost their balance. No, these men, they came to worship the Lord. They came to pay homage. They got down on the ground intentionally. They decided that they were going to honor Jesus in the best way, in the fullest way that they possibly could. Sometimes people get down on the ground and they beg for their lives. They're pleading for some kind of second chance. They're looking for mercy. But these men, they had some understanding of who Jesus was. So they wanted to show respect. They wanted to show humility. And they wanted to honor the Lord. There again is a practical point for us. When we come to worship, and we may do that on a regular basis, how respectful are we? I think that we do a good job. I think we do a fine job of that here. But that's a question that we should always be asking when we come to worship. It is possible to be disrespectful when it comes to worship, and that's not what we want to do. Now, the New Testament does not tell us what position we must assume when it comes to worship. Did these fellows fall down to worship? Yes. That's specifically what we find in Matthew chapter 2 and verse 11. But the Bible doesn't say that we're forbidden from worshiping by sitting. It doesn't tell us that when we worship, we need to kneel or we could be face down on the floor. It doesn't give us a particular position. But it does tell us in various ways, and especially by use of this word, that we do need to be respectful of God. We need to honor God. We need to show reverence for God when we worship. Thus, we're faced with this question. Do we strive to be respectful to God when it comes to worship? We also, as we look at Matthew 2 and verse 11, find that worship costs these fellows something. They offered unto him gifts like gold. That's the first one that's mentioned. Have you ever looked at this particular passage and wondered how much gold did these guys bring to worship? That's a good question. Did they bring an ounce, less than an ounce, more than an ounce? Gold would have been expensive in this day and time, just like it is in our day and time. Did they bring perhaps a pound or more of gold? And we might ask, too, what about the carat of gold? How fine, how good was the gold? Was it the least expensive gold, or was it the most expensive gold? We don't know. But since it is associated with the word worship, we would expect that it was a costly, it was a noteworthy gift. There again, as we look at this word and we think about some application, we are faced with this question. When we worship God, does it cost us something? I have known of people over the years, and perhaps you have as well, maybe you've been in this position. They have, and not in a bad way, but they have spoken very favorably, almost to the point of bragging, about the place where they worship because it was so close to their house. I've had people tell me, I worship 2 minutes from the church building, and that's by walking. It is a stone's throw for me to get to the church building. And people have sometimes talked about how quick and easy it is for them to get to worship. There's nothing wrong as far as living close to the church building. If that works out for you, that is a great thing. But I will tell you that as you look at people and they are involved with worship, sometimes for a person it is costly just to get out and worship God. There are people, because of where they live, because of where a congregation is, they spend half a tank of gas either getting to or getting to and from worship. Half a tank of gas every time they come to worship, and maybe a little bit more. Others pay a cost when it comes to energy. There are people, and if you are a Christian long enough, you get to know enough about fellow worshipers, you will probably at some point find that there is a Christian in your congregation or another congregation, they suffer from a serious illness. It might be that they have a significant disability. And as you learn more about that person, you might find that just getting up in the morning is a challenge. If they have to go to a doctor's appointment, it's very difficult. If they have to go to weekly worship, it costs them something. It is a challenge for them to get up and to get out. Now, we might be at a time in life where we can get up and we can be dressed and we can be out the door in 5 minutes. Or maybe it takes us 10, or maybe it takes 15 minutes. But for us, we can kind of jump up and we can get out, and it's not that big of a deal. Right now, as we go through life at this particular stage in life, worship really doesn't cost us anything as far as mobility, being able to move quickly, thinking of it in terms of time and energy. But there are other people. When it comes to worship, it costs them something every single time they come out in terms of time and energy. For other people, you think, for example, about the single mom. Perhaps she has 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 small children. Or you think about the grandmother who's trying to bring her grandchildren to services. And you see the struggles. It's clear that it's not easy. It costs those women, or it could be a man, something to get to worship every single time they come out. There can be a cost when it comes to participation. If you talk to most song leaders, they'll tell you that they put some time and energy, they put some effort into worship. And it costs them something. Sometimes it costs them their voice. When we make an offering to God, we may dig deep, and that costs us something as well. It's not like leaving a small tip at a restaurant. The very nature of worship should cost us something when we come. If nothing else, participation. It makes it, as you look at Matthew chapter 2 and verse 11, it makes it sound like worship is very valuable. And that's true. We have reinforcement of that point in Matthew chapter 4 and verse 9, 2 chapters later. The devil met up with Jesus as the Lord was being tempted. And Satan, as he meets up with Jesus, he could have wanted all kinds of things. The devil could have looked at the universe and out of all the things that exist said, I want this, I want this, I want this. But out of all the things that Satan wanted, do you know what he wanted most? It's found in Matthew 4 and verse 9. The devil said unto him, that's Jesus, all these things, the kingdoms of the world. The devil claimed that he had access, he had control of all those worldly kingdoms. And he said, I will give you, Jesus, every kingdom. Wherever it is on the planet, you can have it. And the only thing that I ask from you is worship. You can be a worldwide ruler if you will simply worship me. It seems to me from Matthew chapter 4 and verse 9 that the devil had a really good understanding of worship. Maybe Satan understands worship a whole lot better than we do. If this was the only thing that Satan wanted, that implies in a very strong way that worship is really, really important. Jesus seemed to indicate that the devil was onto something as far as the importance of worship in Matthew chapter 4 and verse 10, that very next verse. Then, after Jesus heard that, after he was presented with the devil's offer, he said to the devil, you need to go away. And then he gives this reason. It is written, you shall worship the Lord thy God, and him only shall thou serve. Jesus said that worship is only for God. There is no angel, not even the archangel, that is worthy of worship. There is no human being, no matter how powerful, no matter how godly, no matter how wealthy, there is no human being that is ever worthy of worship. There is no animal on this planet that is worthy of worship. There is no heavenly body. There's no planet. There's no constellation that's worthy of worship. Out of every single thing in the universe that exists, only one is worthy of worship. Only one can be acceptably worshiped, and that is God. If there were no other text in the Bible to tell us about the uniqueness of worship, this is it. If something is this special, if something is this unique, we might then wonder who could participate in it. Who's eligible to worship? I think I'd like to know that question. Well, sticking with what we're looking at, let's go down as far as our study of this word and see how it's used in Matthew chapter 8 and verse 2. There the Bible says there was a leper, and this man comes to Jesus and he worships him. This is the same word in the original text. You may or may not know that in the ancient world, lepers were bad news. If you were a leper, you were an automatic outcast when it came to society. You didn't go and live with your family members if you were a leper. You lived outside the camp. You did not live with your family unless they were also lepers. You, if you were a leper, were faced with seclusion day after day, hour after hour. If God was going to exclude anybody from worship, you would think that it would be someone like a leper. These people would be likely candidates. Under the Old Testament system, if you were a leper, you would not be going to the temple and offering worship to God. That would have been absolutely forbidden. But in this case, though, Matthew chapter 8 and verse 3, the Bible says that Jesus cured this man. Christ welcomes this man. The Lord opened up the path for this man to worship God, and that's significant. We can talk about Jesus and the healing and how wonderful he was to this fella, but Jesus opens up the door for this man to worship. God welcomes worship. God desires worship, and God seeks to make worship possible for us. All right, if God is interested in sick people having the opportunity to worship him, what about the people who are rich? What about the people who are powerful? In our day and time, if you listen to people talk, sometimes they would be social influencers, sometimes they would be politicians, but you occasionally hear people demonized. If someone is wealthy, if someone is powerful, they are sometimes described as evil, wicked, and greedy people. If wealthy and influential people are mentioned in the Bible, are they welcomed by God when it comes to worship? Let's take a look. Next chapter, Matthew chapter 9 and verse 18. Here again is our word worship. But this time the worship is being offered by someone who is described as a ruler. Did Jesus, when he dealt with this ruler, when he dealt with this man who was powerful, when he dealt with this man who was rich, did he stop the man's worship? Did he say, you are evil, you are greedy, you are rich, you go away? We don't want worship from people like you. No. You find that this man had a sick child. He had a sick daughter. Jesus goes to this man's house. Jesus cures this man's sick child. He actually brings her back from the dead. So here is another example of someone, perhaps by the standard that society would use, would be an outcast. But Jesus accepts this man's worship. He responds to that worship in a very favorable way. As you're thinking about worship, or at least as I'm thinking about worship, based on what we've seen thus far, several points have been made. Now we've seen some information as far as who Jesus will accept. I might be thinking, scratching my head a little bit, and wondering, if he accepts a wide variety of people, if anybody can come and worship him, what about a variety of places? You may, if you've been a Christian for very long and you've talked to some people about the gospel, you might have had someone say something like this to you at some point. You believe that worship must take place at your church. If worship is not done at your church, you don't think God's going to count it. When somebody makes that kind of statement, and I've had that said to me a number of times over the years, they make some serious mistakes. Mistake number one is they are associating the church building, the place of worship, with the church. So we don't have a church. The church is the people. It is not a building. Secondly, when we think about worshiping as the church of God, we are talking about being a member of Christ's church versus a church built by man. Third, I do not know of any Christian who believes that worship must take place in a building, at least no member of the Lord's church. Take a look at Matthew chapter 14 and verse 33. Again, we have here the word worship that we're looking at, and they were in the boat. Here was boat worship. Now, I've worshiped in some strange places, but to my recollection, out of all the places that I've been, out of all the places that I've worshiped, I have never worshiped on a boat. I can't ever remember worshiping on an airplane. I do think there was at least one occasion overseas when I worshiped on a train, but I've never worshiped on a bus. I've never worshiped on a subway. When it comes to worshiping God, we can worship in all kinds of places. We don't have to be here. We don't have to be in a pew. We don't have to be in a building which has the word church on it. There is no prescribed place for worship when it comes to New Testament worship. In addition to that, we have some information about gender or sex. In Matthew chapter 15 and verse 25, here's our word popping up again. She She came and worshiped him. Males and females are both able to worship God. The male can worship just as acceptably, just as well as the female. New Testament worship is to be carried out by the male. That's not what we're looking at tonight, but when you do look at that, the Bible teaches that male spiritual leadership is in the church, but even that being the case, not every male is going to serve in exactly the same way. Worship is designed to be an inclusive activity. Every person who is a Christian, male, female, rich, young, educated, poorly educated, it doesn't matter. It is an inclusive activity. It is for all people who become children of God. Worship, it is possible to do that as an individual. It's possible to do that as a congregation. It's also possible to do that as a family. In Matthew chapter 20 and verse 20, we come to the next use of our word. Then came to him the mother of the sons of Zebedee with her sons, and notice this, there's that word again. They worshiped him. Families may or families may not do a lot of things together. But one of the great blessings in a family unit is worship. In our time, we see the family unit being attacked in a lot of different ways. One of the tools, one of the ways people can strengthen their family is through family worship. Attend worship together. Participate in worship together, and talk about worship together. Not that you're trying to tear apart the service or engage in a critical evaluation, but you can talk about the service. Some things that you learned that were new, some things that maybe raised some questions in your mind. When kids grow up and they begin to have their own families, continue as a parent or grandparent to further the discussion about worship. It is a great thing in some places that multiple family members, as far as generations, have participated in worship. There have been times where you have three generations maybe serving at the Lord's table. Or, if you're really fortunate, you might have four generations that are participating in worship. As a young person, my mom tried to get me to go to worship at times. And I will tell you that my parents were surprised at the way I turned out. I was probably the least likely guy ever to become a preacher. In my teenage years, I resisted going to worship, and I resisted a lot. Mom did everything she could, and I was just no, 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 and no. Sometimes it is this child who's dragging his or her feet. But you know, sometimes it's not a child. Sometimes it's an adult. Sometimes it is a grown-up that almost needs to be drugged to worship. The word that we're looking at is relevant as we think about this. Take a look at Mark chapter 5 and verse 6. Here's the word worship again. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran. This guy runs to worship. Now, can you imagine that? Did you know that verse was in the Bible? Can you imagine someone running to worship God? Oh, we might run if there's danger. We might run if there's an emergency. If something's being given away for free and we think that it might be all gone before we get there, we might run to get in on the deal. There's certainly some people who run for exercise. But imagine someone being so enthused, so overjoyed at the prospect of worship, they run to do it. That's what we have in Mark chapter 5. And verse 6, well, in our family, for whatever reason, we might not run to the car when it comes time to worship. But you know, as we think about worship, we can grow in our enthusiasm for it if our desire is not all that strong. If we're someone who, when it comes to worship, we don't really look forward to it, well, that's an honest admission, and that's good. That's a step in the right direction. Work on that. The change in our attitude may not be immediate, but we can alter our thinking. Our goal should be this. Luke 24 and 52. And they worshiped, there's that word again. They worshiped him, and then they went back to Jerusalem. Notice these words, three words. With great joy. It is possible to worship God, and from that experience, get great joy. Now, for some, that might take weeks. For some, it might take months. And there may be some people, it takes years for them. But it is possible, if we live the Christian life, to come to worship, and for us, it is a joyful experience. Worship becomes a privilege, worship becomes an honor, and worship becomes the highlight of our week. A story is told about a worshiper who left a service one day and had a chance to say something to the song leader. The worshiper said to that song leader, "I didn't like the hymns that you selected today." And the song leader gave a fairly quick response. He said, "That's okay. We didn't sing them for you." Now, it took some bravery on the part of that song leader to make that statement. But that was a smart response, and I don't mean smart aleck. I mean, that was an intelligent response from this guy. You see, when we begin to realize that worship is not about us, it's about God, it begins to change our perspective. We get a brand new outlook on worship. Work on making worship the highlight of your week. It will change in a drastic way your Christian life. It really will. It took me a long time to get there, but I got there, and you can too. Will that be something that you commit to in the new year as we stand and sing?